morning show.
All right, let's get a little geeky.
All right.
I like doing that. All right. A little tech geeky here as we welcome back to our show, Dr. Sasha Meinroth from Penn State. Welcome.
Welcome indeed. It's wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you in person this time.
Indeed.
So there we go. You've been a busy fellow lately, and I kind of follow things on social media, and I see, okay, Dr. Meinroth is there, now he's over here, then he's going there, talking about stuff that I think is important as we look to the future and so on. So first off, let's get some background for folks who aren't familiar. Tell us something about yourself. What do you do? What do you do with Penn State? Why do you have frequent flyer miles, apparently, or driving miles, whatever they are? Tell us about you.
Sure. So what do I do? Well, I raise four vivacious young daughters. That keeps me quite busy.
That's your opening.
That would keep you busy.
So, you know.
You are busy.
Everything else is interstitial. It all happens, you know, in between that primary role. But at Penn State, I am the Palmer Chair in Telecommunications, which is an endowed chair that, in essence, is a platform for, I would say, thoughtful, visionary leadership in these spaces of tech and telecommunications. As it turns out, technology, communications, these are growth sectors. This is a very busy time for those of us that are in this arena.
Boy, and how rapidly it is changing.
Indeed.
Yeah, that's got to be a challenge, just keeping up on literally by the minute what changes are occurring.
Every 24 hours, I feel like there's a new dumpster fire.
Yeah.
And like a fireman, of course, technologists run towards these kerfuffles.
All right. So the Palmer chair. Now, see, that's the Jeff Ironhead chair. This is the Scott chair. I have no idea what chair you're sitting in right now. We haven't named that chair, but Palmer, Palmer, who's Palmer? What is that?
Yeah, so the Palmers are actually kind of institutions here in State College, right? So if you've ever been to the Palmer Museum, if you've ever seen the different array of services and public institutions that they've supported, and I am sort of, I guess, the personification of their support for higher education. So I have an endowment that supports the work of myself and my teams provided by the Palmers. And there's a bit of an irony here, which is that they got their funds in the telecommunications arena, selling, in essence, their businesses to larger mega corporations. Huh. And as the Palmer chair, I'm very critical of, I would say, the business practices, especially the malfeasant business practices of these same corporations.
So it's the age of disruption.
It is definitely the age of disruption.
Okay.
And what we hope is that there will be some creative destruction that will eventually benefit us. Obviously, what we are sold is often quite a bit different than what we actually receive.
Ooh.
Now, with your role, how much, if any, interaction do you have with the students here? Like, what kind of input or feedback do you get from the students, if any, directly?
Yeah, so I teach courses here at the university, and I love teaching. I enjoy it greatly. My students at least report that they like it greatly as well. But this semester, I'm actually I've bought myself out because I'm working on a book, and so I needed concerted time, uninterrupted time, in order to sit down and write.
All right, we'll bite. What's the book?
Ooh, well, the book is on the early progressive era Federal Trade Commission.
Ooh.
And so the history here is after the robber barons of the Gilded Age, the Rockefellers and Carnegies, the folks that kind of divvied up the economy in their own little fiefdoms. One was railroads, one was steel, etc. We put in place a number of protections. And those protections were enshrined in something called the Federal Trade Commission. And the Federal Trade Commission, you can think of it as it's the consumer rights organization that balances the different needs of people and corporations.
Yeah.
And I'm writing about why that was created, what was happening in the era that it was created, and then drawing the parallels from the robber barons of yesteryear to the tech barons of today.
So is that good or bad? I mean, are things going well or not well? What would that be?
Currently, we're not on a very good trajectory, but I'm an optimist. I think there are mechanisms for correcting, and I think there's a high probability that we will find ways to, in essence, forward the social contract, the balance between corporate rights and responsibilities, public interest, and consumer protections. However, we are currently living in this era whereby there are no rules of the road. And as such, we have all manner of problems. Many of your listeners are going to have experienced at least several of these in the course of your everyday lives. This is technology run amok.
Okay. Elon Musk high on your popularity list? Tell the truth.
Elon Musk is an interesting character. I did get to have dinner with him some 10, 15 years back when I was still in the DC think tank realm. Very smart man, and also clearly running amok, which is to say a lot of his work is both incredible and innovative, or I should say the work of his companies is incredible and innovative. And, you know, there's a certain arrogance that comes from being an insulated multi-billionaire who never gets told no. And I fear that that is what we are seeing writ large with, for example, Doge and et cetera. That even though I think there's widespread agreement, hey, we'd really like to prevent waste, fraud, and abuse, I think the harms that Doge is going to cause and is already causing are pretty profoundly bad. And if we wanted to stop waste, fraud, and abuse, we would start by reining in the waste, fraud, and abuse of corporations. We wouldn't be squeezing blood from American families, from our elders, from farmers. That is not where the fat is. The pork, as it were, is really accruing to a very small segment of very powerful companies.
I could disagree with some of that, but
please.
That
would make for a much more interesting show, yes.
What the heck? All right, let's go down this road a little bit. I've heard about $300 hammers and $500 toilet seats through the government forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's got to be a ton of waste in there, and nobody down there up till now has been willing to do anything to rein in that waste. All right, now we got some, call them firebrands or something, that they're going to, woo! Are they a little out of control? Yeah, more than a little. But if we're actually going to start cutting some of that spending and waste, you're going to have some wild people that are going to have to get in there and get it started.
Yeah, well, and again, that's the place where I think there's widespread agreement. Like, I haven't heard many people saying we don't want to go after waste, fraud, and abuse. It's tactically how you go about doing that. And right now we're seeing, I think, a lot of collateral damage. And the expectation is that that will also provide for a good outcome. But when we're cutting things like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or IRS funding, we know that for every dollar we spend in these agencies, we generate revenue. So it's actually having the opposite impact. By cutting capacity of these agencies, we're increasing inefficiency. And I'm not saying that that was the plan. I'm saying that's the outcome. And, of course, that's before we get into things like the National Park Service. Everyone loves our national parks. So cutting that, yes, it doesn't generate revenue, but it increases our quality of life.
All right. Well, one of my favorite lines is it possible to go too far with something? Yes.
Yes, indeed.
And it just goes back and forth and so on. All right, now let's talk about some things that you've been tackling in particular. Now, when we had you on before, it was broadband.
Indeed.
All right, broadband.
Still is, yeah.
Yeah, it still is, because there's still, if we localize it to here, like out where I live, yeah, I kind of have broadband, but I'm still waiting for much better broadband in a rural area. And I think about my friends in northern PA, and some places they got nothing. So what's up on the broadband front? Has anything improved, like, since the last time we had you on, like a year ago or something? Since the last time we had you on, has anything gotten better?
Well, let me be an equal opportunity naysayer, which is to say the Biden administration slow-walked funding to bring broadband, including the over $1 billion to bring broadband broadband to some of the least served areas of Pennsylvania. In 2021, that money was allocated. It still hasn't gotten out the door. And that's egregious. That's lunacy. That is ridiculous. On the other hand...
Is there a reason for that? I'm sorry.
No. The reason is bureaucratic inefficiency. Right? And that,
I mean, it's not like a deliberate, hey, we're going to teach you guys a lesson. We want something changed about the way you're doing things in Pennsylvania. It's just bureaucracy.
It's bureaucracy. It's egregious bureaucracy. So Now having slammed the Biden administration... The Trump administration has nominated a woman named Ariel Roth to run NTA. That's the government agency that oversees this massive pot of funding for bringing broadband. And they want to just stop the funding entirely. She comes out of Ted Cruz's office. He's against the program. So on the one hand, you have the Biden administration slow walking the funding. And on the other hand, you have a Trump administration that's on record saying we don't need the funding. Meanwhile... The people of Pennsylvania are still desperately in need of big, affordable broadband connections, and it's unclear at this point in time. And again, I'm an optimist, so I'm hoping that this program will, in fact, not get cut. But right now, it's looking up in the air.
I tend to be an optimist as well, and I tend to...
Hope springs eternal.
...want to find... workarounds around the bureaucracy that is government.
Indeed.
Is there any opportunity out there where it's like, hey, we recognize we need this, either through those corporations or, and I'll delve a little bit more into have we had any explanation from Ted Cruz or Donald Trump? I mean, I don't know how you could say that this isn't necessary in order to function in today's society, but...
Right. So the argument is these subsidies, these grants, are unnecessary because private companies will provide. And that runs... in direct contradiction to the lived reality of people that are like, private industry is not providing.
Yeah.
But we need to do something to bring this. In the same way that we did with roads and schools and electricity and all these other critical infrastructures.
And it's just not, there's not a financial incentive for the companies to provide correct me if I'm wrong, but the cost to get it northern Pennsylvania covered for the population there, the return... isn't going to be worth it? Is that what the companies
are basically saying? Well, here's where it gets weird. You can still earn profit. It's quite profitable, but it's not as profitable as... So imagine if you are a stockholder in a mega company and you have $1 billion to invest in infrastructure. Where do you put it? You put it where it's going to earn you the highest return on that investment. So this is why you end up in this kind of weird, psychotic state of broadband, where... places that would be profitable, you create barriers to entry. And Pennsylvania has, for example, state laws that prevent people from providing broadband connectivity. For example, an anti-muni bill. Because you could make it profitable. And therefore, the companies want to sort of reserve those constituencies for future investment. So many communities are just the collateral damage from these processes. It's very bad. In essence, if we had a meaningfully competitive broadband market, a lot of these problems would go away. But we don't. We live in a duopoly. There's basically two companies serving most households in the United States, if you're lucky. And that leads to all manner of sins. Slow speeds, high prices. Which is why the United States, when you look at highly industrialized countries, we have very low speeds and the highest prices. It's us and Canada, basically, the highest prices for broadband connectivity.
Yeah, I'm trying to watch a Penn State game at night, and halfway through the game, I get the spinning wheel of death.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that drives me. Now, this is not just Pennsylvania.
No.
It's every state, probably, right?
Correct.
Okay. It's
every state. Some are worse than others. But it is also differentiated by states. We see states now that are actively and have been actively investing in broadband, which is to say infilling areas where private industry is not reaching, providing subsidies, et cetera. Pennsylvania is surrounded, except for maybe Ohio, surrounded by states that are doing far better than we are in providing universal, affordable connectivity. In fact, when you look right north of us, New York has now mandated $15 broadband, a tier of broadband connectivity, baseline broadband for $15. Now, I would challenge you, like, do you even know anyone in Pennsylvania that's paying $15 for broadband?
I'm not.
That, to me, is the role of a state balancing private profits and public interest.
Do you know what the money that is hung up, that was sitting there?
$42.45 billion.
And that's nationally?
Yes.
Do you know how much was designated, or was there a specific portion that was supposed to be allocated to Pennsylvania? Or
not supposed to be, was. What? Is okay. Allocated. So we get $1.14 billion just for
incredible
supporting broadband connectivity. It was part of the 2021 IIJA stimulus bill, and we are now in 2025, so we've been waiting for this money to actually walk out the door for almost half a decade now.
Wow. All right, incredible. Let's take a break now that I'm depressed. we're talking with Dr. Sasha Meinrath of Penn State. Now, we come back. We'll see if I can not get depressed. All right, we're going to talk about AI. Interesting stuff there. Quantum computing, which you did something in that topic recently, and some other topics. So, friends, you're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox. Folks, we're going to get the bureaucracy out of the way here.
Yeah, we're going to try.
But first, we got to take a commercial break. We'll be back.
For quality you can see and wear, remember PAMP for customized t-shirts, letterheads, envelopes, magnetic signs, and business cards. PAMP has a low minimum of 12 shirts for printing and no minimum on embroidered items. They don't charge art fees or setup fees. Pricing is simple and easy, and they have a quick turnaround. They're open Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Located at 136 South Harrison Road, Pleasant Gap. For more information, call 814-359-2447.
The Center Hall Farm Store is proud to serve our community as a small family business that provides big-time service. Folks, you can still stock up on those wood pellets this winter. The Center Hall Farm Store makes its own horse, cow, pig, chicken, and bird feeds and has a great variety of pet feeds for your needs. Open weekdays from 8 to 4 and Saturday from 8 to noon. Check us out at 110 Allison Street in Center Hall or on the web at centerhallfarmstore.com. That's centerhallfarmstore.com. The Center County Recycling and Refuse Authority is proud to support local sports here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. Check out our website at centercountyrecycles.org for employment opportunities, upcoming events, the authority's newsletter, and details on what can and can't be recycled, as well as updated schedules. That's centercountyrecycles.org. Once again, the website is centercountyrecycles.org.
The days are getting longer, and sooner than you think, the lawn will need mowed. So, decisions have to be made. When you roll out the old mower that just barely made it through last summer, or visit Dotter Equipment just south of Mill Hall on Route 64 and see a great selection of Kubota. Dotter Equipment offers the Kubota B or BX Series compact or subcompact tractors. Either way, with Kubota, you get the number one rated brand in durability, ownership, and the reliability of any under 100 horsepower tractor in the USA. Maybe a tractor isn't what you had in mind. How about a Kubota zero turn mower? Something with lots of horsepower and 42 to 72 inch mower width. You can zip and zoom across your lawn with precision and ease atop a Kubota residential mower. Lawn care never felt this good. Indeed, decisions have to be made. So, to get answers to all your questions, visit Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64 for Kubota Lawn Care Products.
The Fox!
It's Let's Talk here on a Tuesday morning. Jeff and Scott with you. A little open phone time coming up in the final segment of today's big show.
$8 for a dozen eggs. $15 for broadband. That's not what I'm paying, but
no.
Thanks, Sasha. Thanks a lot. No, our guest is Dr. Sasha Meinrath from Penn State, talking, you know, tech issues. Because am I right? You've been doing a lot of traveling, like giving speeches or doing conferences and stuff like that.
Everything from giving speeches to climbing around splicing fiber. Yeah, I do it all.
You do that too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. You want to come out to my house? I've been waiting for fiber at my house. All right, let's talk about some other things. All right, AI. AI, you know, every day, new stories about AI, and it's wonderful and it's awesome. And I tell you what, it is. I mean, I'm an old guy. All right, Scott, the old guy. And I used my AI app the other day for something, and I now know how to work it, like how to do what's called a prompt and make it a really good prompt.
Excellent.
And boom, and I did this the other day for something I'm working on, and it comes popping right out. I'm thinking, wow, that's really good. Now, since we had you on, AI has gotten so much better, or it's the same, and there's just a lot more people doing it. I mean, what's the state of AI right now?
Yeah, so it is definitely getting substantially better at certain things. And that, you know, is really great. I mean, in terms of productivity, in terms of getting baseline answers, in terms of being able to assist and speed up your work. AI is the equivalent of a computer, a word processor, a spell checker. The problem, as epitomized by spell checkers, is that just because you have a word spelled correctly doesn't mean it's the right word. And AI does not just words, but entire paragraphs or statements. It's the ultimate in providing definitive answers that might be completely incorrect.
Well, let me ask you, I've actually gotten inundated just in the last week, just between a podcast I listened to and now I've seen two different articles on one of the looming issues that seems to be out there with AI is the amount of energy that it takes to support these AI, I don't know, housing or complexes or whatever. How much of a concern is the energy? I mean, we just talked about broadband in the United States compared to other industrialized nations. Not great. It seems like we have kind of self-imposed some regulations that maybe are setting us a little back here on the energy grid front. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on where we're at just on the energy grid here in the, let's say, the next couple of years as AI seems poised for this explosion?
Yeah, so you have a variety of technological software developments that are incredibly processor intensive. And because they are incredibly processor intensive, they require a lot of energy. So encryption, crypto mining, AI all fall into this. And so you're actually seeing this kind of exponential growth in energy consumption to the point, I'm not making this up, where Google has announced that it's going to become a nuclear power. It is literally buying nuclear reactors to run its data centers to offset the increased energy usage in not wholly, but in large part due to the ever-increasing exponential growth of AI use.
Well, Three Mile Island.
What could possibly go wrong?
They're restarting TMI simply to power these massive buildings. Not in Pennsylvania, I don't think. I think, can you? I'm a Civil War guy. All right, I love history, and so I belong to some organizations. Mm-hmm. And apparently, Google, whoever, they want to build these massive data centers in Northern Virginia, mm-hmm. where very close to Civil War battlefields. And some mm-hmm. of these folks are like, no, we can't let that happen. We got to raise money, buy the land, yada, yada, yada. Why Northern Virginia? Boy, just because it's close to D.C.? Why there?
When you're building a higher tier data center, there are requirements around. You don't just need power. You need the intersection of multiple energy grids. And as such, there's these narrow places that you can actually build data centers. They need both massive power, but they need redundant power. And as such, there's key locations that have the kind of necessary infrastructure to support the what's called five nines, 99.999% reliability of that data center. And Northern Virginia is one of them. And that dates back to military industrial complex. It dates back to the early ARPANET and the early internet. You look at the root servers for the internet, they're all in those same locations. Like, there's a variety of reasons for this, but long story short, if you were to take a map of the United States, there's probably less than 1% of the land area where you would actually want to put these data centers, because less than 1% is located in those spaces between multiple energy grids.
And Northern Virginia happens to be one of those.
Yeah, I think there's three or four different independent grids that all intersect right in that region.
Why doesn't Google just make their own nuclear reactor? Make their own nuclear reactor.
Well, again, I think that is exactly the redundancy that they're looking for, that if you can have a very highly reliable energy source like nuclear power, that if that's on site, it adds another layer of reliability to a data center.
But it's a process, right? Like it's, I think it's an 8 to 10 year to, you know, from start to finish to get that up and running.
Yeah, I think these things are being delivered like in the late 2020s or something like that to start with, and yeah, I'm sure that'll get pushed back.
So putting a bunch of solar panels on the roof will not get it done.
Well, it'll help, although solar is probably, you'd need fields of solar to run a data center. But yeah, I mean, you want, again, multiply redundant structures. So you want your generator, you want your solar, you want your wind, you want your energy grids, you want your nuclear. Like, you layer multiple different ways to get power. Likewise, you also layer multiple different cooling. And I mean, there's a lot that goes into these data centers that, unless you're geeking out and diving into this as we are right now, like, you would just think, oh, it's just a big warehouse. No, it's actually a very complicated series of infrastructures that all have to be brought to bear. This is very expensive, and it is also very energy intensive, which is to say, when you have multiply redundant ACs, I don't know about you guys, but like, you know, in the summers, it's already expensive. Now imagine you've got massive redundant infrastructure of that sort all being run and cycled and what have you. It's very expensive to run these things.
Yeah, we just need to not have anybody run the AC on the, you know, those really hot days. Just wait till they're cooler and then not everybody. I always love that. It's like, mm-hmm. well, that's the only day you really want to run it is the issue here. I mean, I get the demand thing, but it's like, that's what we want for our energy sources.
That's all right. And if people can't access their, you know, downloadable, you know, kiddie videos when they want them, they'll riot. So, of course, these things have to always operate. And yes, they can't fail.
All right. Now, you work for a university.
I do.
What a coincidence. How much has AI really changed anything? Huh. I mean, or is it just a fancy, shiny Google?
Well,
it hasn't really changed much.
It fundamentally alters pedagogy. It alters teaching. It alters learning in the same way that computers did. You know, I'm probably one of the first professors at the university that embraced AI and told my students explicitly, like, you need to know how to use this. What we don't teach is how to use this very, very powerful tool. Which is to say, it can do wonderful things to accelerate your research. And if I'm looking for a surface-level analysis, it can provide that. But if I'm looking for depth of analysis, the deeper you go into almost any topic the higher the probability that AI is going to get things very, very wrong. And in the courses that I teach, I see this. If you become over-reliant upon the answers from AI, you are almost assuredly going to get bad information and therefore going to propagate bad information in your final paper to me. And I can tell you, if my students in a tech policy course are giving me funky information, they're going to be surprised because I will say that is wrong and you will get dinked on your final grade. And I will say right now people are a little confused because when they think about how I could write 5 years ago versus today, their papers have improved. On the other hand, I have also raised my bar. I assume today that you're going to have correctly spelled words, which wasn't always the case. If you look at theses from the 60s, you find all sorts of misspellings in these things. Long story short, people are not aware both of the limitations, but also of the fact that the entire world has evolved. If you have no value add, you do a fantastic prompt, you spit out whatever that prompt spit out, and you give it to your boss, well, a trained monkey can do that. You have no value to your future employer if that's all you can do.
Okay, I mentioned the example where I used an AI app recently, and it spit out good stuff. I looked it over.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and it was like 10 points, and I looked over the 10 points, and I thought, yeah, okay, that sounds right to me. You're saying a lot of folks don't bother to look it over? They just hand it in?
They copy and paste, and some of it's obviously incorrect. But some of it's very subtle that you, again, I view AI, and I use it as well, as sort of an accelerant to some of the initial due diligence. It provides me the threads that I pull on. But I do not rely upon it as a replacement for actual expertise. And so teaching students, hey, you need to go back to the primary sourcing that this thing is drawing upon. Have it give you the citations for the information it's providing you and read through that.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that, if you're relying on secondary or tertiary sources, you often run into pretty substantial problems, especially in areas of legal interpretation, technology, critical analysis. What AI can tell you is what the general thinking around these issues are because the models that create AI synthesize those results from common knowledge. And whereas common knowledge can be good sometimes, especially in deep areas of expertise, it turns out the common man is not very knowledgeable. And AI, unfortunately, pretends like it's got the definitive answer, no matter how uncertain that answer actually is.
All right, now I'm curious. Do you grade things the way you've always graded them? I could see an AI app where if you're getting papers from students, pretty much you just me, like a fax machine. Just put it right in. Okay, AI app, go ahead, grade this for me.
Yeah, I mean, that would be tempting. I would get very rote, banal kind of answers to that. So I could use that if I had, like, you know, my grading rubric. I could fit that into the AI model and have it spew out an answer, but it wouldn't be personalized. It would miss a lot of the key points. It certainly wouldn't synthesize across my knowledge of the student, what we've talked about, and et cetera. It just doesn't have that in the model. And so when I'm providing critical feedback, I could use AI if I were like, do you have a budget in your business model? It can do that fine. Have you synthesized the budget with what's happening in this sector in the here and now? AI is going to miss that almost every time.
All right. So how close are we then to a model in the future where it picks up all the little intricacies that a person would?
Yeah.
Is that even possible?
Well, this is the holy grail, right? The generalized artificial intelligence, something that actually is intelligent. Because the sad reality is there is no AI. There is no artificial intelligence. These are just very, very complex algorithms. And as such, they follow their programming. So, yes, the goal eventually is to get what's called an AGI. And we're not close to that yet. And it doesn't look like it's coming anytime soon. It will become more and more difficult to differentiate sort of AI-generated content from sort of the banality of everyday content creation, which is to say it's going to require us to raise the bar to expect more of ourselves. But the same was true when we created computers, right?
Yeah.
Think about the access that you or every student today has. I still remember from my college days having to use an actual card catalog in my research. Mm-hmm. And that was not ancient times. So the speed and access to information that we have today is remarkable. And what's happened is that we expect much more. We should expect much more. We have access to much more. That doesn't mean that we're being wise and thoughtful about how we use this access to unprecedented information and resources. In fact, as it turns out, we get kind of a little bit lazy. And that can be very, very dangerous when we don't, again, in this moment, don't appreciate that expertise, wisdom, is often outside of what AI can provide, but is being turned in, whether to me or your future bosses, as I tell my students, as knowledge, when in fact it's just the prompt's answer.
Hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Like knowing what to do with that information versus having the information. Like, you might be able to regurgitate the information or provide the information, but the context and how you then actually mobilize I think is an entirely different matter altogether. And maybe this stuff will get there someday, but feels like we're ways off.
That's right. Well, and teaching my students or the general public, like, look, when you're using AI to determine an answer to a question, you can also have AI rip that analysis apart. You can feed that back into the AI and say, like, tell me everything wrong with this. What are the detractors from this position? What's the other way to look at this? And it will provide you a countermeasure. And into that, you start teasing this apart. You start getting a sense of, like, oh, wait, this is not definitive often.
Yeah.
This is one of many answers, and it has shortcomings. There's artifacts, there's alternative hypotheses, there's, in essence, more to be gleaned. And if you're not doing that, well, then you're not fully harnessing both the power of AI, but also appreciating its limitations.
So no AI wrestling announcers anytime soon.
No, well, they're working on it. I mean, you see
this
stuff.
They're working on it. Oh, yeah. Oh, are you kidding me?
Bots to call scores for games and what have you. This is a low-hanging fruit in the same way that, like, long-haul trucking, automated vehicles for long-haul trucking, that's easy. Trying to drive down College Avenue here in State College is a very complicated algorithm due to all the lemmings. On the other hand, if I just have to go onto I-80 and drive straight for 100 miles, that's a very easy one. Same thing with, unfortunately, and I know you guys don't want to hear this, but calling games, summarizing stats, that's low-hanging fruit for bots and AI.
Oh, Ironhead, I'm sorry. I should have
It was a good run.
Terribly sorry. Dr. Sasha Meinroth's our guest. I can't believe you just said that. All right, we got a few minutes here. Quantum computing. You've done something with that recently. First off, define quantum computing. as best you can. Now, why are you laughing? What is this thing, this weird thing?
So it's probably easiest to define it by contrasting it with your traditional computer. So your traditional computer has a bunch of transistors. Think of them as light switches. It's on or off. And a light switch is on or off. A quantum computer is on and off at the same time, which is hard to get your head wrapped around. So instead of having just one state that's definitive, it can be in both states simultaneously. So you can think of it as this fuzziness that you can then run computations with, which is to say, in a traditional computer, if I want to run a simple math problem, I have to flip all these switches to do the computation. In a quantum computer, I can do it, in essence, instantaneously because each switch is in both states at the same time. Now, this sounds impossible, but at the quantum level, below atoms, it is, in fact, a property of physics. So you have things called qubits. That's these switches that are in both states simultaneously, on and off. And you can build computers with them. They're not very big computers. The number of qubits in these computers is very small. You have like billions of transistors. You have like 130 qubits. But certain things, certain functions, these computers in their infancy can do it orders of magnitude, hundreds of times faster than the fastest supercomputer today. Now, on the one hand, this is fantastic and wonderful. We can fold proteins and analyze all these things around medicine and what have you at an unprecedented rate. The other kinds of things you can do, though, is like break encryption, which means all those transactions that you've made online that are safe today, all those credit card numbers that have been sent over the internet that are encrypted, might be decryptable in the very, I won't say immediate future, but over the next quarter century. Now, this has a date. At some date certain, we are able to break encryption. And this has a name. It's called Q-Day for Quantum Day. And a Q-Day, in essence, fundamental large sections of our secure data becomes insecure. And that is the downside risk of quantum computing. So, yes, I'm just a ray of sunshine today.
Boy. Yeah, I'm totally depressed now. So
the quantum, that's a lot to wrap your head.
So the quantum world, which is where Ant-Man lives. Right?
Indeed.
See, I follow this stuff, right?
Okay,
I know all about
Ant-Man,
this stuff, where Ant-Man lives. Now, allegedly, what was the story like 2 weeks ago? Microsoft allegedly has a new chip for quantum computing.
Mm-hmm.
First off, what do you know about that? Is that legit, or is this just all hype?
Probably both, which is to say, yeah, there is a massive multi-billion dollar effort among some of the largest mega companies in the tech industry to develop quantum computers, because they represent, much like the abacus to the computer is the computer to a quantum computer. It is a radical improvement on computational capacity. And therefore, whoever can develop the first functioning general use quantum computers is going to, you know, run the tables. It is a transformative technology at a very fundamental level. And likely, these breakthroughs are likely to see widespread adoption within the next, I'd guess, quarter century. And again, there's once you dive into the technology, there's a lot of unknowns here. But we have seen steady progress in the research and development of quantum computing over just the last dozen years or so.
So we're going to figure out warp drive.
Well, fundamentals of physics might make that a little more difficult, but I would never say never.
Okay. Now, we keep hearing us and China, China and us, us and China.
Yes.
Is that all it is? It's us and China? Somebody else in the world must be working on this stuff.
There are. I mean, there's a number of Israeli firms that are out there doing a bunch of stuff, a lot of European firms. You know, you got CERN in Switzerland that's doing it. There's a lot of effort on a global scale. But China is our boogeyman du jour, and therefore, you know, when we're thinking about who's the opposition, we tend to put China there, and rightfully so, right? I mean, China's got, you know, 300-400% of the population. It has an incredibly vibrant research and development sector. The number of patents, many of which are bad patents, but the number of patents coming out of China, I think, has now eclipsed more than the number of patents that the U.S. has generated on a year-by-year basis. That just has happened in the last 2 or 3 years. So a lot of innovation happening there. My hope would be that we see future collaboration in this space, because the technology has the potential to so greatly benefit and to so greatly harm all humans, that there needs to be some rules of the road around what is allowable and not. And again, this is yet another area where innovation has completely outpaced rule of law. There's just no meaningful, functional, national or international agreements on what is allowable and not within this domain.
See, this is where somebody will get mad at me. When I think about space travel, like Donald Trump wants to put Americans on Mars. Like the 51st state is not Canada. It's going to be like Mars. Okay, that's going to be the 51st state. And it's going to be all ours. And I just think, no, when we leave orbit, we're humans. We're not Americans, Chinese, Russians, Iranians, and so on. That's what drives me a little crazy about this stuff.
Correct. And there's a number of international agreements mandating that nobody gets to own the other planets or what have you. How that will be respected in real time when the boots hit the ground, the yes, dust of Mars, we hopefully get to live to see. I mean, I'm, again, an optimist. I would love to see us extend our reach. It'll probably be, you know, robots or androids for as much as we've already put robots on Mars. Yeah. But I think becoming a interplanetary species, I would love to, on my deathbed, look back on the days of yore when we were relegated to a single planet as the history and vibrant coexistence on multiple other planets as our future.
If we don't kill ourselves first.
Well, there's that, sure.
Well, there's that. Thank you. Okay, now that we've totally depressed everybody, Dr. Meinrad, thank you very much for coming in. We've had a lot of fun.
Thanks. Go have a great rest of your week with the impending doom of the planet.
No, this is exciting stuff. If we do it correctly.
The liberatory potential for these new technologies is expansive. The quality of life improvements, amazing. The benefits to humanity, really remarkable. And that doesn't get us wisdom and knowledge about the implementation of these technologies.
Thanks for coming in today.
We appreciate
your time.